Welcome to the Get Us Out of Retail podcast, and this is our Halloween special, so I really hope you enjoy.
Hello, hello.
Hey, so this is a spooky episode, as we were just discussing before recording. It's our Halloween-themed episode.
We be doing the spookies.
We do be doing the spookies. We have the lights out, even though it's kind of not the best because Parker's window, like, there's just so much light coming through.
I tried.
So it's not dark in here, but we do have a candle, and it's coffee-scented, and it smells very, very good.
So if you want to truly enjoy the experience, you can turn the lights off, maybe go in your bathroom or something, and, like, put some candles on, some spooky music with us, and just vibe.
Exactly. I think I'm gonna add some spooky music, too.
Hell yeah.
In editing, add some, like, because I normally do lo-fi, maybe I'll do some, like, creepy-esque lo-fi.
Hell yeah.
Do some horror music or something.
Yes.
But yeah, this is a spooky vibe. What we are going to be doing today is going to be reading mainly true crime stories, and I found an article which I don't even know where the article's from. The Lineup? I've never heard of that. But it's an article that I found when Googling, like, disturbing true crime stories. And some of you might know that I'm actually a crime major, so I know a ridiculous amount about all of these because I've had to study it. So we're gonna have fun. We're gonna read some stories, get kind of spooky up in here.
Those are spooks.
So, we're just gonna go and we're gonna read these stories off of this article. There's 11 stories, we're gonna take turns. And we're just gonna talk about each one too. And just get all the spooky vibes.
I feel like you have way more facts about half of these than I know.
Well, yeah, but that'll be interesting. And, like, the viewers will not know a lot about this, like, certain ones. Well,
that's what I mean.
And then other ones will know a lot more.
Yeah.
So it'll be fun.
That's what I'm saying, is, like, you're gonna have your own input on this. And you're gonna be like, wow, that's fucking crazy. I'm losing my voice today. Goodness.
Always losing your voice.
I really am.
All right, so you're starting us off with our first story.
Okay, so this one is called The Boy in the Box, which I have never heard of.
Extremely popular one. Most of you will probably at least have heard of it.
I have not, though. But in February of 1957, a college student stumbled upon the remains of a young boy in the woods of Philadelphia and reported his gruesome discovery to the police. The boy was found badly beaten and laid to rest inside an old bassinet box. His identity was unknown. Several people came forward with information relating to the case, but the police were not able to verify anyone's testimony. One woman, by the name of Martha, claimed that her abusive mother bought the boy. Under their roof, he was subjected to physical and sexual abuse. What made the police take interest in Martha's story was her knowledge of details that had not been released to the public. She claimed that shortly before the boy was beaten to death, he ate baked beans, which corroborated? Which corroborated the autopsy. She also claimed that he was bathed before his death, which matched the coroner's finding of water-pruned fingers. Though Martha's testimony seemed to match the evidence, her substantial history of mental illness made her an unreliable witness. Another lead came from a psychic who accurately described a foster home near where the boy had been found, without ever having seen it. Remington Bristow, an employee at the examiner's office, followed the psychic's direction to the foster house. Inside, he discovered a bassinet matching the description of the bassinet box the boy was found in. He also found blankets similar to the one that was wrapped around the boy's body. Because there was no real incriminating evidence against the foster parents, Bristow's findings were dismissed as well. 62 years later, the case of the boy in the box has gone cold. Facial reconstruction technology has provided mock images of what the boy might have looked like alive, but no one has ever come forward to claim him. DNA and dental testing has also been attempted with no success thus far. The identity of the boy in the box remains unknown to this day.
So the reason why this case is very popular, it's like talking about child abuse and how and people getting away with it. So yeah, interesting story. There's not a lot to add since the case has gone cold, but it's obvious that someone, like, did horrible things and got away with it. It's kind of insane to me.
Yeah, which I feel like it happens a lot more than we talk about.
Definitely, yeah. And then, like, when I think about those cases, I always think about, like, Gabriel Fernandez, which I haven't had you watch that, that documentary on Netflix yet, but it's really good. And that's what happened to him, is he was living with his parents. Well, he was living with his mom and her boyfriend. And the child abuse was so bad that he died in, like, 6 months.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and what was interesting about that case, it's one of the most interesting cases of child abuse ever, is that there was multiple different police officers and CPS workers that actually entered the house during the time where he was basically being killed, like, very slowly. And no one ever did anything.
Of course.
And so the CPS workers were actually put on trial after that. It's really interesting. Okay. So moving on to the next one. It's called the Icebox Murders. In 1965, Fred and Edwina Rogers were living in Houston along with their grown son, Charles. The family mostly kept to themselves in their quiet neighborhood, especially given Charles' reclusive and antisocial behavior. In fact, many neighbors were not even aware that Charles lived in the home with his parents because he left the house each day before dawn and didn't return until well after nightfall. When a family member hadn't heard from Rogers in several days, he called the Houston police for a welfare check on his elderly aunt and uncle. The patrolmen were unable to locate Fred and Edwina, but they noticed food sitting on the dining room table. They opened the fridge and noticed numerous packages of meat neatly stacked atop one another. Then they noticed two human heads in the vegetable bin. That's nice.
Ew. Now you're reading this and I'm literally going, what the actual fuck?
Mm-hmm. Additional officers arrived on the stomach-turning scene and slowly removed the packages full of dismembered body parts from the fridge. The remains were that of Fred and Edwina Rogers. The police deduced that Edwina had been brutally beaten and shot, while Fred suffered forceful trauma to the head. His eyes had been gouged out and his genitalia removed. The couple's innards had been flushed down the toilet. Charles was nowhere to be found. Naturally, Charles was the prime suspect in his heinous crime. However, he seemed to have vanished off the face of the earth. The police were able to collect circumstantial pieces of evidence against him. Charles Rogers was never found.
What the fuck?
So that's really interesting because, especially towards the end there, is that he did all these things to his parents, right? Yeah, his parents. And then he just disappeared.
What the hell?
And that was in 1965, so, I mean, he could still be around. Like, he just disappeared and, I guess, got a new name or something, or maybe he ended up dying and was another case that they just never figured out who it was.
That is absolutely wild to me. What the fuck?
Yeah, he just did that to his parents and just moved on with his life.
Yep. Okay.
That's crazy.
That's very crazy. So, the third story we have is about a woman by the name of Dorothy Jane Scott. Early in 1980, Dorothy Jane Scott began receiving threatening phone calls at work. She was the single mother of a toddler who didn't think much of the calls at first, until one night when the sinister voice over the phone told her to look outside. A single dead rose was lying on the windshield of her car. The stalker who had gotten a hold of her number would oscillate between professing his love for her and threatening bodily harm. Dorothy mentioned to several family members and friends that the voice over the phone sounded familiar, but she couldn't quite place who he was. She never got a chance to find out. One night, at a staff meeting, Dorothy noticed one of her coworkers looked ill. She and another colleague drove the man to a nearby hospital. The doctor said he had a nasty spider bite and would need a prescription. While the two co-workers were waiting for the prescription to be filled, Dorothy went out to the parking lot to get her car. It was the last time she was seen alive. Her co-workers testified that after she did not return, they went out to meet her in the parking lot. At that moment, they saw her car speeding away, so they assumed there was an emergency with their son. Dorothy never returned home to her son, nor did anyone hear from her again. 4 years later, her charred bones were found at a construction site. Adding just another layer of mystery to the case is the fact that a set of dog bones were found right next to her remains. Though people on the internet are still discussing the case today, no one was ever convicted or held in suspicion, and the mysterious caller was never found.
It's crazy. It's a little dramatic, though, with the person who was stalking her, like, leaving a rose and stuff.
Yeah, but, like, I feel like that's such a common thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because, like, I feel like whoever did it was, like, definitely into poetry or something.
Yeah.
Because that's very, like, Edgar Allan Poe-esque.
But it also sounds similar to, like, the person who's my stalker, that definitely sounds like something he would do.
It's, oh,
like,
yeah.
It's just dramatic.
Yeah.
It's like, come on.
Yeah, no. Fuck him.
No, that sounds about right, though, for what? Just, like, a stalker.
Yeah. Is. That's really creepy, though. What's with the dog bones?
Who knows? That's, yeah, like, where did that come from?
Maybe he was trying to cover up her, the scent of her bones with dog bone smell?
Who knows? Like, it's very common that serial killers fuck around with animals, so who knows?
True.
Who knows what happened?
Can confirm as a psych major, that is a very common thing.
Yeah. So, the Chicago Tylenol murders is the next one we're going to be talking about. In September of 1982, a 12-year-old girl in Chicago passed away shortly after ingesting an extra-strength Tylenol. The same day, a man died in a hospital after taking the same pill. Two of his family members followed. Over the course of the next few weeks, more seemingly healthy people in Chicago dropped dead. The only thing they had in common was taking extra strength Tylenol before their untimely death. As bottles were recalled by Johnson & Johnson, it was discovered that many of the extra strength Tylenol pills had been laced with potassium cyanide. Once this was made public, Johnson & Johnson issued numerous ads and warnings to customers to avoid the product. The company began working... I can't say that word.
Fervently?
I can't say that word.
They be using too many words that we can't say.
They be working hard, is what they were doing. On a triple sealed package that would prevent tampering. James William Lewis of New York City contacted Johnson & Johnson, claiming that he was responsible for tampering with the bottles and filling the capsules with cyanide. He demanded $1 million in exchange for him to stop. That's not how it works, sir. He was arrested for the crime, and although he wasn't found guilty, he was still in prison for extortion. Even after Johnson & Johnson fortified their Tylenol bottles against tampering, the widespread news of what happened in Chicago promoted crimes of similar nature around the country. Several more people died from cyanide poisoning found in other over-the-counter medication. The Tylenol murders is one of the few true crime stories to spark real change in the country. The quality control of pharmaceuticals increased tenfold, and as did the security of their packaging. Although the FBI didn't have enough evidence to convict anyone of the crime, it was widely believed that James William Lewis and his wife were indeed responsible. When I was reading that, I'm like, so that's why we have to, like, peel off those annoying things that, like,
yeah, I was
that
gonna,
are on the top of pill bottles.
I was going to say, like, God fucking damn it, you that's ruined why. It for all of us.
Yeah.
I can't believe I've never heard of that. That's so recent, too.
Oh, yeah, it's another really popular one. You live under a rock or something.
I do live under a rock.
Because I've definitely, like, I don't know all these cases by heart, but I've definitely heard of every single one of these.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely shook right now.
I feel like, this is probably untrue, but I feel like it's a similar thing to, like, when parents are like, don't eat the Halloween candy because it could be laced with something. Like, I'm sure that was a different crime, but it still reminds me of that.
True.
You know.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
You know, gotta eat them razor blades, kids.
Yeah.
So the next one is called the Girl Scout Murders. So that's a little scary, as Wee Parker was a Girl Scout at one point.
I was a Girl Scout, too.
Oh my god! Crazy. So in the summer of 1977, three young Girl Scouts staying at an Oklahoma campsite were sexually assaulted and murdered. The girls, Lori, Michelle, and Doris, were between the ages of 8 and 10. That's sad. That's well, sad
Lori,
as shit.
Michelle and Doris.
I think Doris was the one that just threw me off.
Yeah.
Poor Doris. Rest in peace, probably. We haven't gotten that far in the story. I don't know what happens. About 2 months before the murders, a camp counselor found a disturbing note in her belongings. The culprit promised to murder three children at the camp. Knowing that young campers enjoy telling scary stories around the campfire, the camp counselor dismissed the threatening note as nothing more than a prank, a decision she would come to regret. Early in the morning of June 13th, the girls' bodies were found in their sleeping bags out on the trail leading to the camp showers. The only evidence that their killer left behind was a red flashlight and a bloody footprint. The prime suspect in the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders was Jean Leroy Hart, an escaped convict. Hart had been raised about a mile from Camp Scott, and at the time of the murders, he was at large after escaping from prison, where he had been serving time for burglary, kidnapping, and sexual assault. A local jury acquitted Hart of the crime, citing a lack of evidence. However, Oklahoma police considered the case solved. To this day, no one knows if Jean Leroy Hart got away with the murder or if the true killer was someone else entirely. Either way, the girl's killer never saw justice.
Fun one. How fucking heartless do you have to be to go kill some Girl Scouts? Like, what did they do?
Yeah. They just tried to sell you goddamn
they're
cookies.
They just vibing. Like.
God fucking damn it. What if we wanted Thin Mints?
That's also, like...
All jokes aside, that's really fucking
well,
sad.
Well, it's very terrifying because it's like, you know, they tell stories around the fucking campfire and these girls actually got murdered.
Yeah.
That's insane.
No, I feel like I would never go camping again.
Be a little bit more scared knowing that it was based off a true story.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Okay, the next one is the Unicorn Killer.
What the fuck?
Well, I guess we're gonna find out.
My God.
This is actually one I haven't heard of, so.
Okay.
As an adolescent, Ira Einhorn gave himself the nickname the Unicorn, the English translation of his German surname. Oh, he's Einhorn. Okay.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
The killer was an environmental activist and part of the anti-war movement when he murdered his ex-girlfriend, Holly Maddox.
Pause.
It's kind of counterproductive.
Yeah, I was going to say, that is so counterproductive. It's kind of sad.
Maddox disappeared in early September 1977 after stopping by Einhorn's Philadelphia apartment to collect her things following their breakup. That sounds familiar. Anyway. For context purposes, I don't even think you know this, I was assaulted, like, after getting my stuff after a breakup, and so men just like to do that, apparently.
Well, God fucking damn it.
Yeah, several weeks after Maddox's death, police questioned her ex-boyfriend about her whereabouts, to which he stated she had disappeared on the way to the neighborhood co-op. 18 months later, the neighbors began reporting a rancid smell. Police found Maddox's body stuffed in a trunk in Einhorn's closet. Several days before Einhorn was supposed to stand trial, he fled to Europe. As Einhorn had already arraigned, the court was able to try, convict, and sentence him in absentia. So I guess, like, when he wasn't there, they were still able to convict him.
Oh, nice.
Despite the fact that Einhorn managed to remain in France for 23 years, even getting married, while craftily evading extradition. The U.S. government was finally able to bring him back to the States and reconvict him in 2002. Einhorn is now serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole.
Intriguing.
Very. That's super interesting. I think that if you're going to have a body, don't shove it in your house. Probably smart.
Yeah, you would... I'm sorry, did you just think you were going to hold a body for 18 years? Or 18 months or whatever?
Yeah. And
just never going to rot or anything?
Like, he should have went to Europe. Like, he should have just left her in the house and then went to Europe, and they would not have been able to find this man.
Yeah. What the fuck?
No common sense.
I have no clue how the hell to say this name. Sai?
Yeah, it's spelled I-S-S-E-I, in case anyone is curious. So sorry that we're butchering these names.
Yeah, there's like a last name.
But I think it's like Japanese or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is Japanese.
And then, I don't know how to say that last name.
Yeah, it's like Sagwa? Sagwa?
Like
I don't know, I'm trying to learn Japanese.
Close enough,
Jesus.
Y'all can look it up, it's fine.
So, we're just gonna butcher the hell out of this, and I'm sorry for all my stuttering.
He's a cannibal, it doesn't matter.
True, yeah, you know, no respect for the cannibalism, that's fine. This cannibal became a local celebrity after signing himself out of a Japanese mental institution, dear God, in 1986. Asai came from a wealthy family and had exhibited cannibalistic urges from an early age, even attempting in bestiality. Sounds about right.
He was engaging in bestiality.
Engaging in.
He did. He done did.
No. You know what? That's actually pretty common from what I've been told in psych.
Disgusting.
Yeah, usually it kind of coincides. At 1823, dear God, I cannot talk
you
to
you. Almost had it.
Listen, I cannot read anything out loud. It's always been a problem.
That. This is a little bit of a struggle, but there's only a few left.
Yeah, it's fine. At 23, he made his first attempt at eating human flesh, breaking into a woman's house to cut off some of her flesh. disgusting. He was caught and charged with attempted sexual assault. Later, he would move to France to earn his PhD in literature. I'm sorry, what? It would be then, at the age of 32, that Cy would kill and eat his classmate, René Hartevelt? Hartevelt. He admitted to luring the 25-year-old Dutch woman to his apartment under the guise of working on poetry.
Again with the poetry.
Yeah. I'm starting to see a pattern. Yeah. It's making me feel bad as being someone who loves poetry.
Right.
What the fuck? He said he chose her for her beauty and health, two things he believed that he lacked. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because you're a cannibal.
Yeah, exactly. After shooting her in the neck, okay, he ate various parts of her body over the course of 2 days. He then attempted to dump her body, including two suitcases of her dismembered body parts, into a lake in the Bois de Boulogne. I'm assuming that's a river. Or a lake. It's a lake.
Yeah, he dumped it into a lake.
Yeah. France. Yeah. Fancy lake, French name. But was caught in the act. After being held for 2 years in police custody, Assai was deemed legally insane in French court and was ordered to be held indefinitely in a mental health institution. Dear God. After being deported to Japan, he was declared sane by a Japanese psychologist and so was able to sign himself out of care. How can you call anybody a cannibal sane? Especially as a mental health professional. What the fuck?
Interesting. Well, I mean, there's a thing between, there's, it's different than the legally sane. Like, true. There's legal sanity, and then there's regular sanity.
Yeah.
The only thing I wanted to point out about this is it said he exhibited cannibalistic urges from an early age, and I just want to know what that looks like. Like, do you have a child, and he's just, like, wanting, saying that he wants to, like, or is taking an interest in meeting people? Like, that's really interesting to me.
I want to know if they just, like, completely misread what this kid was doing. Like, maybe he was just, like, biting on his friends or something, and were like, yeah, he wants to meet people. Like, what the fuck?
Or they knew, and they just didn't get him help.
Could be that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, lovely title for the next one, The Granny Killer.
He kind of looks like a granny almost. They got a picture of him.
Maybe he was insecure about that.
Probably. Just probably, God damn it, I turned old.
An English-born Australian serial killer, John... What is with John Wayne? Like, with John Wayne, all their fucking serial killers start with that name.
That's so funny. I think this is the only one I've ever heard of.
Well, it's John Wayne Gacy.
Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, and then there's this guy, John Wayne Glover.
I feel like I've heard of him too. Anyways, continue.
Was known for preying on elderly women, including the widow of artist Will Ashton. Over the span of 14 months between 1989 and 1990, Glover murdered 6 elderly women after brutally attacking them. At times, he simply used his fist to attack the victims. He used objects like hammers, his victims' pantyhose, and other instruments. Many of his victims were simply women he saw walking past him on the street, with whom he struck up casual conversation. In addition to attacking and murdering those 6 women, Glover was also accused of sexually assaulting several other elderly women. At his trial, a psychologist noted that Glover was sane. But while Glover was sane, he had a severe personality disorder, which may or may not have been connected to his turbulent relationships with his mother and mother-in-law. After being found guilty and sentenced to prison, Glover killed himself in 2005. Days before he died, he handed his last visitor a picture he had drawn featuring 2 trees and the number 9. Supposedly 9 is the true number of murders Glover was responsible for not merely the 6 which he was convicted. Interesting.
I might be a dick for saying this, but he's dead and he killed people, so it's fine. I feel like he only preyed on elderly women because he wasn't strong enough to kill anybody else.
Probably.
Because, you know, first off, that just makes him even more of a dick, I feel like, because now he's just preying on people who definitely cannot protect themselves.
Yeah.
So, like, what the fuck, man?
Yeah.
Why would you hurt an old lady? Some of them are nice.
Exactly. Yeah, that's... But it's just, like, in court, the psychologist was just like, he has a personality disorder and he doesn't have a good relationship with his mom. That's why he did this.
Yeah.
Like, no, he's a killer. That's why.
That's my big pet peeve with the psychology community, I feel yeah. like, because they always are like, it's because they had a bad relationship with their mother. Well, guess what? I also have mommy issues and I'm not going to go murder somebody. Yeah. It's not an excuse. Like, put your mommy issues down and think about what the fuck you're doing.
Sure.
Insane. So, the next one we're going to talk about is the New Orleans Axeman. This American serial killer was active in the greater New Orleans area between 1918 and 1919. The majority of the murderer's victims were from the Italian immigrant community and were killed with an axe that belonged to them. The killer would access his victims' homes by removing a panel on their back door, then enter and murder them with either a straight razor or an axe. Okay, Sweeney Todd. The brutal serial killer attacked at least 12 people total, most of whom were women. In March 1919, the unidentified killer sent a deranged letter from hell, where he described himself as invisible, even as the ether that surrounds your earth. I am not a human being, but a spirit and a demon from the hottest hell.
You're not that cool, sir.
In the letter, the Axeman stated the date and time of his next planned murder and suggested that the only way to stop him was to play jazz music.
Jazz music's really calming, to be fair. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I was like, what the fuck? What kind of jazz music, sir? Is there like a description here?
Nope, just jazz music.
Just any jazz music. Okay. In response, the entire city filled its buildings and streets with the music sound that night, and no one was murdered. The axe murderer would strike three more times before his activity eventually ceased. Today, the story of the Axeman has been repopularized thanks to similar character in American Horror Story Coven.
Yeah, so obviously I already knew about that because I'm a big fan of American Horror Story, and if you want to know more about that, definitely watch Coven. It's very, very good.
Please tell me they did the jazz scene.
Yeah.
Oh, hell
yeah. They told the whole story. It was really good.
That's awesome.
We're gonna have to watch it. That's a really good show to watch around this time of year, especially
but,
the spooky vibes.
But, like, why does that feel like the Joker? Like, that seems like the Joker would do.
Well, I mean, almost every serial killer that's very crafty like that kind of has Joker vibes.
That's true.
Because they do just weird stuff. Okay, so we had the boy in the box earlier. We're talking about the girl in the box this time.
What's with boxes?
Well, good places to put bodies, I guess. 20-year-old Colleen Stan was on her way to a friend's birthday in Northern California when her soon-to-be captor, Cameron Hooker, and his wife, Janice, picked up the hitchhiker. Stan would spend much of the night in the much of the next 7 years trapped in a box that let out no light, sound, or fresh air, convicted by the hookers that a mysterious and dangerous or convinced by the hookers that a mysterious, dangerous, and dangerous organization would kill her and her family if she didn't comply. Under an agreement between Janice and Cameron, and eventually through a forcibly signed contract with Stan, the young girl was to be a sex slave for Cameron. That's nice. Like, though it didn't, I'm not gonna say that word, but it didn't initially occur. When Stan was let out of her box, where she spent up to 23 hours a day eating cold food scraps, and using a bedpan, she was tortured and assaulted using various objects. Several years into captivity, a brainwashed Stan was allowed to visit her family and once even got a job, but when Cameron said he wanted Stan to be his second wife, the entire horrifying situation fell apart. Stan eventually got on a bus and fled to her family, while Janice turned her husband in, receiving immunity for her full cooperation. Interesting.
How did she stay in a box with no light, sound, or fresh air for up to 23 hours?
Well, I mean, Gabriel Fernandez pretty much did the same thing because he was locked in a cabinet and he had like his hands and feet tied, and so he just had to stay like that for most of the day, so.
But wouldn't you run out of air?
There's probably cracks in the box. I don't think you'd run out of air completely. You might have trouble breathing. you're completely
most interesting.
Likely. What's interesting about this to me is the fact that she visited her family and got a job. And obviously it's not the same situation, but like I relate to like being in a lot of shit and still just, you know, just seeing your family and just doing what you need to do. Like, it just happens, especially when you're brainwashed. It's just the way it goes.
Wild.
That is crazy. That's one of the I have not heard of that story. That's really crazy to me. I'm glad she got out. It kind of pisses me off that the wife got immunity, though.
Yeah.
I hate that. I hate when family members get immunity. I don't think it should be allowed, but anyway.
Yeah, especially not when you're kind of a part of it.
Well, yeah, like, it's not like she couldn't have not known. Like,
exactly.
She obviously participated, and then she's like, oh, it's my husband. Whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, so you are going to read the last story we have for us.
Cool. So the final story is about the eyeball killer.
What interesting.
What a name.
Right off the bat.
Yeah. You know. This Texas murderer and diagnosed psychopath killed at least one woman with two more suspected murders to his name. Adopted from an orphanage, Charles Albright was cared for by his very protective adoptive parents. His mother was a school teacher and helped accelerate his learning so far that he entered college in his teens. Despite being so bright, he was also known for partaking in criminal behavior. Arrested first for aggravated assault at the age of 13, his murderous roots, however, lied in a childhood interest. After Albright received a shotgun at a young age, he used it to kill animals. That is very common.
Yeah.
He would then stuff them with the help of his mother, appeasing his interest in taxidermy. This kind of sounds like, what's his name? Jeffrey Dahmer.
It sounds
a lot like Jeffrey Dahmer.
One thing I want to point out there is, like, children can get guns at a young age and hunt. But, like, there's a distinct difference, I feel like, whenever you're, like, killing animals that you shouldn't be hunting and then also doing it like purely for pleasure.
Yeah, like the fact that you can enjoy that and be like,
Because I was around guns at a young age and I did hunting at a young age, but it wasn't like that.
Yeah. No, I definitely think there's a very fine line.
Yeah.
And he definitely crossed it.
I didn't ever like it. When I was messing with the animals, I was like, ew.
I'd be crying. My dad wanted me to hunt when I was a young age and I was like, I love the animals though.
Like, we did squirrels and rabbits and I never like wanted to touch it afterwards. I was like, I'm a good shot, but I don't want to touch that.
What a mood. So after failing to complete pre-med training at both North Texas University and Arkansas State Teachers College, he would be sent to jail for theft, sexual assault, and eventually the murder of a sex worker. Although police suspected him of at least three more slayings, his victims' bodies were left nearly or completely nude out on a city street. They had been shot in the head, and their eyes had been removed with surgical-like precision.
Fun.
Yeehaw. What the fuck?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Just what the fuck.
Maybe he just had good practice on taxidermy as a kid.
True. I feel like he was just fucking around and being like, oh, what does this do?
Because I don't know how taxidermy works, but I feel like they probably get something out of the eyes. I don't know. I never did that.
Well, did it say he did the taxidermy?
I think it said his mother held it, but he might have done it. Hold on.
Doesn't say just having things taxidermy, I don't like see the problem with that, but
I don't know, it's always made me uncomfortable. Hold on. Yeah, he would then stuff them with the help of his mother, appeasing his interest in taxidermy.
Interesting.
Thanks, Mom. You helped raise a serial killer.
So, one other case that I wanted to talk about, like, I have another list of, like, if any of you are interested, this is a pretty good list of things, and it's from distractify.com, and it's the worst crimes in the 50 states. But the one I want to talk about is the one for Indiana, because if you don't know, we are from Indiana. And I actually learned extensively about this case in my serial murder class that I had to take. And so I'm just going to talk about it quickly. So there's this lady named Belle Gunness, and this was... Okay, yeah. So what this lady is, she's essentially like a black widow. And she marries people, kills them, kills the children, all that fun stuff, and then starts over again. And this was in Indiana, and like I said, she's born like 1850-something, and this all started in 1884 when she got married. They owned a candy store, which got burned to the ground, and then their couple's homes burned. And so for some reason, this lady just keeps getting out alive with all of these, like, husbands getting burned to death and then gets the insurance payout. A little sketchy. And then it says her two babies were in the home. They died from inflammation of the large intestine, which can result from poisoning.
Yeah.
So she's poisoning her kids, collecting the insurance, all that stuff. But she did it, like, a bunch of different times. And then, this is one of my favorite parts of the story, is she began placing marriage ads in Chicago newspapers, because she was in Indiana for a little bit, and then also in Illinois for a little bit. She began placing marriage ads, and the ads were answered, and then that just gave her more opportunities to kill people.
I was wondering why this story sounded so familiar. Mm-hmm. It's not that I know the story, it's when our college put on a show called The Drowning Girls, mm-hmm. like last year or the year before that, like before all the COVID stuff hit. Mm-hmm. It's a very similar story, but instead of the woman doing it, it's these two men.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's basically the whole story. It was a really good show, but I was like, why does this sound so familiar? I bet they wrote the show. I'm, like, looking up the show right now, and I bet they wrote it based off that.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. I mean, it's bad, but...
I'm trying to look at how she died. Because I don't think they know for sure if they caught her or not. Yeah, it says that she's been the subject of two, like, musical ballads and stuff, so I'm sure that you've heard of her through something like that.
Probably.
Anyway, I just find that story interesting because she just kept killing people and getting the insurance, and I think that's neat.
Very Chicago-esque.
Well, especially because female serial killers are very, very, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
It does not happen, typically. And so to learn about that, and especially in the 1800s, really interesting to me.
True.
Is there any stories you want to talk about that you know off the top of your head?
I don't know a lot. Like, the main story that I really know about that's always intrigued me mm-hmm. was about that, she was, like, a beauty pageant girl, and they never solved the story.
It's, like...
Renee?
What's her name? It's, like, Jean Benet.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Jean Benet. Jean Benet. That's what I'm talking about. I think that's her name. Yes.
Yeah,
John. I love her story.
I don't know hardly anything about the
case. Oh my gosh, if you could, like, read it one day, it is so fascinating. Mm-hmm. My dad and I don't always get along, but, like, occasionally we'll get on these, like, random story, like, spiels. Mm-hmm. And if I really just want to, like, ramble, because I love rambling, I'll straight up just bring the story up in front of, my like, both my parents, and we'll just go on a 45-minute rant about who we think did it.
Yeah.
It is so fascinating to me. It's one of my, like, the best stories I've ever read in my life.
But
if you have never seen it, like, to anybody or you have never seen the show Unsolved Mysteries, there's, like, a newer one, but I'm specifically talking about, like, the original one. There is so many cool, like, old serial case killers and murder scenes and stuff that have never been solved. Some of them have been, which they explain. But they, like, slowly produced the show so people around the world could help think of different ideas and different approaches to all these killers and try to get people caught that the police couldn't handle. And a lot of cases got solved that way. Mm-hmm. That's why I love that show so much.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. One show that I'm going to bring up is called Mindhunter on Netflix. And for those of you who have not seen it, it's actually around the time period that they started categorizing killers and using the word serial killer. That's where the name serial killer came from, is these people in the behavioral, like, FBI department. Anyway, the reason why I bring that show up is it led me to my favorite case ever that I still watch stories about all the time. Like, I still watch old interviews about all the time,
mm-hmm.
which I've told you about the story before, Parker, but you're going to get to hear it again for the people.
You know how I know. I probably don't remember.
I remember you saying it was gross, and it is, but I love it. It's so interesting. So, this killer is the co-ed killer. That's his nickname. His name is Edmund Kemper. And what he did... First off, he killed his grandparents. That was his first crime, and he was, like, 12 or something. I'm doing this completely from memory. I'm not reading this, just so you know. He was, like, 12 or something, and he killed his grandparents, and he got sent to, like, a psychiatric place. He didn't get, like, prison time or anything. And then, eventually, he ended up lying to the people at the psychiatric place and saying, like, hey, I'm good now, I've changed, all that stuff, so they let him go. And so, he lives with his mom. His dad isn't around, he's either dead or in prison or something. And the mom is, like, constantly bringing home, like, different men all the time, and is just, like, not very nice to this guy, to her kid. And she constantly is yelling at him that, like, he's the reason she can't have sex anymore because he's always in the house and stuff like that. Like, saying horrible things about him and saying that he's not a real man. A bad emotional abuse, but doesn't excuse what he's about to do. So he ends up breaking into co-ed dorms in a college. I don't remember which college it was. But he specifically preyed on female college students.
Of course he did.
This was during the 60s and 70s. Preyed on female college students, sexually assaulted them, killed them, did bad things with them after he killed them, all the good stuff. And he only killed like 11 or 12, which is not a lot compared to 10 assists. Which is not a lot compared to most serial killers that I learned about. But the most interesting part about this guy is he kills these co-eds and he goes back to his house and he kills his mother. And he like really drew it out too. Like, he was like telling her that, like, he's that she's the reason why he's doing this and stuff like that. And then he had sex with her corpse after he killed her.
Ew.
Yeah. And so, like, one thing that's super interesting about this guy is he loves to talk. He loves to talk to people, loves to talk to cops, all that fun stuff. And so that's how we know so much about this case, is because he just sits around and talks to the cops about it. But during Mindhunter, you will see him talk to these two detective guys about, like, what he did to his mom's corpse afterwards, because he cut off her head and did it with that. And he describes in graphic detail about what it feels like to do that. And it's really interesting. So that's my favorite case to learn about, specifically because he just talks about anything. He's like, he just sits there and just talks about it. No, like, does not bother him at all. Really interesting to me. I think he's still alive too. Either that or he got killed in prison. He spent the rest of his life in prison.
I kind of want to meet this man. I have so many questions.
No, he's still alive.
I have so many questions on a psychological standpoint alone.
He's in the California medical facility. Yeah, so he's out in California. Yeah, he's super interesting. If you ever want to look up his interviews, because he's done a lot of interviews in prison, so good, so interesting. And, like, he's another one that takes full accountability. He's not one of those ones, like, Bundy's annoying because he's like, I watched pornography and that's why I killed people. That pisses me off. No, that's not the reason why you killed people. Like, he takes full responsibility for it. He's like, I was fucked up as a child and I ended up killing people. And then one of the most interesting points in the show, they ask him, they say, what should we do with, like, the people like you in the world? And he just says to kill them and that there's no other way to change anything. So
interesting.
Yeah, it's really cool to hear his perspective. He's just like, yeah, just kill them. The me's of this world, just take them out.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's my favorite case of all time, so I could not go this long without not talking about it.
I'm intrigued now. What the fuck?
All right, do you have anything else that you want to...
I don't think so. Like I said, you know way more about this stuff than I do. I just like listening to it.
Oh gosh, it's so interesting. That serial murder class, if you guys ever, like, even if that's not your department, like, in fucking college, definitely take a serial murder class, because you get to watch documentaries, you get to read stories. It's so cool.
It's amazing.
It's really, really neat.
I mean, we do a little bit of that in psych, but nowhere near to that extent.
Yeah, I feel like in crim classes, you talk about serial killers almost once a class sometimes.
It's so funny.
Bringing up examples.
Yeah. We talked about them a lot in my sex ed class.
Yeah.
Like, my college sex ed class. It's completely different than the high school ones.
Yeah.
Because we did a lot of research on, like, sexual disorders and everything. Mm-hmm. And so necrophilia was often a common topic. Because everybody was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
We had to do a report. We had to choose, like, one sexual disorder. And I was, like, stuck between necrophilia and bestiality, which is why I know so much about, like, the connection between necrophilia, bestiality, and serial killers, just because it kind of all links up a lot. And it's freaking wild. I could talk about it all day long.
It definitely is. My favorite case actually used to be Bundy, even though it's really popular. I used to know everything about that man.
That's wild.
And I used to, like, what I originally wanted to do, they don't let crim kids do serial killers for any big projects, but what I used to want to do is prove that Bundy killed more than what we actually think he does.
Oh, I believe that.
Because I was definitely, like, on the right track there, and I was doing, like, a lot of very heavy research about that. Because in one of his last interviews ever, because he knew he was going to die, he knew he was going to get executed. Like, he just straight up admitted it, essentially. Well, the thing is, when they interviewed Bundy, it was super, super interesting. Like, I think even from a psych standpoint, where he would not admit that he did things, but if they talked about a killer in the third person, then he would admit it. And so he would be like, they would be like, so, if, like, theoretically, if someone was going to kill someone, what way would they do it in? And he would tell the story in third person and just tell what he did to these people.
That is amazing to hear.
Yeah, and so he would tell it in third person, and that's where he admitted, he was like, that's where he talked about murders that they didn't even know about. But they can't convict him on anything that he talked about in those interviews because he was talking in third person.
Yeah. I see amazing learning, and I'm like, oh my god, hell yeah, do what you're doing. No, I'm like thinking like in a psychological standpoint. Just FYI. Because
yeah.
I sounded really bad when I was like, oh my god, wow.
No, yeah, it's really interesting.
No, it's just like, if you think about, like, you know, from your standpoint with, like, crime major stuff and then my psychological standpoint, it's just, like, somehow it, like, correlates. And, like, we can just nerd about the same stuff.
True.
Just, like, in slightly different areas. That. Yeah, that's so cool.
It is cool.
Like, it's bad, but
no,
it's cool.
No, I found that fascinating. I lost my shit when I found out about that.
That is crazy. Yeah. Like, he's kind of smart.
He was extremely smart, definitely. Like, no one, there are certain serial killers that are dumb as fuck. I will say that right now. But there are some that are extremely crafty. And I think it's interesting to me about Ted Bundy, and another reason why he was my favorite. Whenever someone is going to death row and is about to be executed, they have, like, some sort of priest come in and talk to them. Mm-hmm. It could be, like, a local pastor. It could be, it's usually, like, the chaplain at that federal prison, typically. And they come in and talk to them just about their salvation and shit, because, like, that's part of the death row thing. And so he admitted to this chaplain hours before he was executed that he wanted to kill himself. He was like, I don't want to let them kill me. I just want to do it. I just want to get it over with. And the chaplain said to him, do you really want to, like, add one more soul to the people that you've killed, to, like, the list that you've killed? And he was just like, yeah, I guess you're right. I don't really want to add another one. And so then he was executed and didn't kill himself.
Interesting.
Yeah. But he really wanted to right before. But
went that far, my guy.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It's almost like some Christians think he had a change of heart and actually became Christian before he got executed. But
interesting.
Yeah. But that's why they think that.
Yeah.
It is really interesting. Fascinates me.
Yeah.
And being like, I watched too much pornography and it told me it was okay to treat women that way.
That is not how it works.
Excuse me.
Sir.
Especially for the kind that was back then in, like, what the fucking 70s.
Yeah. it definitely did not.
So funny. He kills me. Like, I feel like even psych majors at that point were like, that's bullshit. Like,
yeah, surely to God.
Well, the thing is, there is a link between that and violent behavior.
Yeah.
There's a definite link, but that, no. That's not the reason why you kill those people.
Yeah. Oh, there's a study, this is like completely unrelated and related at the same time, that they did with children. I don't know what year this was. I just remember briefly the study where they were linking, like, violent media in general. And
I know way too much about this. We do now. Anyway.
But they, like, gave them, like, those blow-up things we have when we were kids, and you could, like, punch them or whatever.
Yeah.
And they were, like, displaying that, like, violent media was, like, causing that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But that was at a young age. I'm sure if he was watching pornography, he was old enough to think better than that.
Well, that's the thing, is there is a definite link between violent acts and pornography. There, like, it has been proven before, but it's hard to research. Because not every person that watches that commits violent acts. Like, speaking of, like, that kind of stuff, like, I did a lot of volunteering for an organization called Fight the New Drug. Like, if sometimes you guys will see me wearing their t-shirts and stuff. And they're not wanting to ban pornography, but they're wanting to, like, limit it a lot and, like, let people know the dangers of it, because it can lead to things like sex trafficking and stuff, mm-hmm. and it's, like, a major part of that. And they have a lot of research. So if you guys are ever interested in that, go on their website and read their articles, because it's super cool. Anyway, anything else you want to add before we wrap it up here?
I don't think so. I think I've gotten my spiel out.
Well, we are going to be hopefully posting this right before Halloween. So happy Halloween, everyone.
Happy Halloween. One of the
good time.
Best holidays ever. Be safe. Don't eat razor blades.
That's what I'm about to say. Be safe. Don't be stupid. If you go to a party, fucking don't be dumb, please.
And remember the rules of Halloween. If you were any trick-or-treat fans, remember the rules.
Remember the rules. All right, we can leave them off with that.
Yeah.
Don't forget to follow us wherever podcasts are available to stay up to date on new episodes. Thanks for watching.